Prison Radio on CKUT 90.3 FM in Montreal and on www.ckut.ca on the World Wide Web. News, interviews, and music featuring the voices of prisoners, their allies, and supporters. Tune in to the Prison Radio Show on the fourth Friday of every month between 11 a.m. and noon, or on the second Thursday of every month between 5 and 6 p.m. To get involved in Prison Radio or finding help searching for past programs, email prison@ckut.ca.
Welcome to the Prison Radio Show on CKUT 90.3 FM. Today's show will feature an interview from CFRC Kingston's Prison Radio with Brian, who was involved in the New Year's Eve noise demonstration in Hamilton, Ontario. In the interview, Brian talks about what noise demonstrations are and how the one in Hamilton went this year. We will also be re-airing part of an interview with the Final Straw Radio from the Final Straw Radio with Walita Imarisha, author of the book Angels with Dirty Faces, and that interview talks about the prison system in the U.S.
But first off, today we wanted to share the report back from the Montreal New Year's Eve noise demo. Each year on New Year's Eve, folks join together to hold demonstrations, noise demonstrations, or gatherings out front of prisons around the world where people make noise, set off fireworks, and generally try to express a message of solidarity to people who are being incarcerated over the holidays. And here is what happened in Montreal this New Year's.
New Year's Eve, for the sixth year in a row, a noise demonstration was held in front of the prisons in Laval. Despite the freezing cold, this year was marked by the greatest participation since the beginning of this tradition. More than 100 people walked around chanting, "Everybody hates the police," and "For a world without prisons or detention centers." The entire demonstration was accompanied by percussion, banners, whistles, and fireworks in large quantities. The group arrived in front of Monte Saint-François Institution Minimum, where the minimum security allowed us to be in direct contact with prisoners inside. Thanks to the windows directly facing the street, they could wave to us, see our banners, and hear us. The second institution we visited was Le Claire, the former and outdated federal prison that was converted to a provincial prison in 2015 and was a provincial prison for men and women until this summer when it became just a provincial prison for women. The prison is very far back from the road, and access to it is usually prevented by the police during noise demonstrations, but the large number of people at the demonstration this year made it possible to get through and around the police lines with joy, everyone engaging in a rather funny race in the snow, during which several policemen were able to appreciate the coolness of the snow. The inefficacy of the police allowed us to set off many fireworks in close proximity to the prison. At the same time, another group of people slipped to the other side of the prison to shoot off some fireworks near the buildings where the prisoners are housed. All of this continued in front of the Laval Immigration Detention Center, where we recalled the importance of opposing the federal government's project to replace the existing building with a new immigration detention center in Laval. This project is part of a broader effort to expand the Canada Border Service Agency's capacity to imprison and deport migrants. We want to see a world where everyone has access to the things they need to. Migrants, denying them a place to stay, and deporting them to situations of extreme danger are things we directly oppose. The entire noise demonstration ended at the Federal Training Center, a multi-level prison, medium and minimum security. When our group finally decided to split in two for the return to the bus, the police chose to take advantage of the reduced number of people to make an arrest. Fortunately, the arrested person was released the same evening, but unfortunately, they are facing charges. Prisons were created to isolate people from their communities. Noise demonstrations at prisons are a concrete way to fight against repression and isolation. We want to extend a message of solidarity to people inside and wish them a Happy New Year, although a truly Happy New Year would be one without prisons or borders and the world that needs them. That was a report back from the Montreal New Year's Eve noise demonstration. Up next, we're going to hear an interview with Rico from CFRC Kingston's Prison Radio. He is interviewing Brian, one of the organizers of the New Year's Eve noise demonstration that happened this year in Hamilton, Ontario. In the interview, Brian talks about what noise demonstrations are and how the one in Hamilton went this year.
All right. This is Rico with CFRC Prison Radio. I am speaking on the phone with Brian in Hamilton. Welcome to the show, Brian.
Hi there.
And I understand that there was a noise demonstration for New Year's Eve this year. Would you be able to explain to our listeners what exactly a noise demonstration is?
Yeah. So every year on New Year's Eve, we do a noise demonstration outside of a selection of prisons in Hamilton and the surrounding area. The noise demonstration is when you would go with anywhere from like two of your friends to maybe like 150, and you just go outside of the prison, usually on public property from the streets or just on the lawn in front of it. And you might bring some signs, and you look for windows for the ranges where the prisoners are, and you potentially wave your hands, maybe bring some fireworks and shoot off fireworks. You bring maybe a big banner that paints a message on it that communicates something. One year we actually brought a physical projector and projected images on a wall, but the main idea is to make noise, make things that can kind of get attention of people when they're on the other side of a piece of glass that's mostly soundproof, and then once you can kind of establish some sort of communication with people, usually people on the inside are going to start banging on windows or waving at you, flickering lights just to demonstrate that they can in fact see you. And it's mostly an effort to try and break down the isolation that people feel being stuck in prison on New Year's Eve, as well as try and make some connections with local people who are incarcerated and let them know that they're not alone on these days that are pretty lonely days to be in prison.
Great. And I understand in Hamilton and area, it's become somewhat of an annual tradition. Would you be able to explain kind of where the idea came from and how it's been, how it sort of behaves as this annual thing and whether that helps people understand what it is when they see it happening?
Mm-hmm. So in Hamilton, we've been doing it for, this was our ninth year of doing noise demonstrations. The first one was originally called, there was some communique or something from Europe that was asking for people to do noise demonstrations in solidarity with some anarchist prisoners across the world. So the first one was actually done just at Barton Street Jail, which we've been doing a noise demonstration in front of Barton Street for 9 years now. And it was originally a small crowd, but it was loud and ruckus and was able to get the attention of prisoners inside. And then since then, there's been a call across North America every year for people to do noise demonstrations, specifically communicated amongst anarchists and radicals and prison abolitionists. And so we've been doing it for 9 years. It started off just doing it at Barton Street, and every year since then we've done sometimes caravans as far away as 6 hours to go to a prison to make some noise, but always wind up back in Hamilton at Barton Street every single year. Part of that continuity means that there's actually been people who've probably been inside and seen us making noise for multiple New Years in a row. We once had a nice message put online from someone who had been inside that day, and they just posted on a like public Facebook Hamilton page a message just saying like, I was in jail on New Year's Eve and I don't know who you guys were, but there's a whole bunch of people who just showed up and started making noise, waving at us, like shooting fireworks, and just kind of communicated a message about how much it was like such a shitty day during the holidays to be in jail, and seeing people come out and just make a bunch of noise and like waving, and like to take that time from like a day when people are out partying and having fun and thinking about the new year, kind of like a nice way to start off the new year, as well as a good kind of like reminder to people that they're not alone, even on days where people probably have a bunch of other things to do. People still make the effort to get out there and demonstrate that it's an isolating experience to be in prison and that there's people on the outside who care. In the past, we have actually gotten a bunch of communication from inside. We've had a banner before that had a P.O. box address on it, and walked around the prison with that, and prisoners inside were able to scrawl down the address and write us letters, and we were able to communicate just through making connections from people seeing the demo. And we've even had some people who have who've been held inside of Barton Street or some of the other surrounding prisons who've come out after the fact and been able to kind of share their experiences, either having been inside of the prison when they saw us doing a noise demonstration, or having been inside the institutions that we're going to, and being able to be on the outside and act defiantly and kind of sympathize with the people inside. So just and this year we went to two prisons. We stuck to Hamilton. We went to the youth prison, the RL Youth Center, which is just south of the city, and then we went to Barton Street Jail. And we had about 40 to 70 people at both stops. There was lots of noise, firecrackers, and some good speeches. We had speeches from a friend who had actually been held in both of those prisons, and he shared stories about what it's like to be inside those prisons, about how things have changed inside of Barton Street with like metal detectors in order to kind of switch up how contraband and things like that get into the prison, which has really just put a lot more control in the hands of guards in order to like control and make money off of the like inflow of that stuff, and also give a bit of context to what it's like to be in these like particularly miserable like penitentiary holding centers. The youth detention center was good. There was a bunch of kids who were able to see us, and it wasn't even frosted glass, so we were able to kind of see faces and like wave and communicate a bit through the windows with them. And then at Barton Street, we did get a very loud and ruckus response from prisoners in the windows, and everything was like pretty fun and relaxed. We had a ton of fireworks and had a big, beautiful banner. And in general, it was a pretty fun and inspiring night, and a great way to start off the new year.
And you said this speaker at the jails, somebody who's been incarcerated in both of them. So do you find that doing these noise demos and other kinds of organizing has led to more relationships with people who are going through those institutions?
Certainly, yeah. It's also just, there's been a bunch of people who have like either heard about these demos, or there's papers have written up about them, as well as just kind of like people coming through. It's not like they're not publicly organized. They're actually just organized through friends who send an email out and like communicate just through word of mouth and stuff like that. So it is hard for a bunch of people just in the street to make connections with us. But through the other kind of anti-prison organizing and prison abolitionist organizing that happens in the city, a number of people have actually been able to seek out people who are doing that organizing every other day of the year, and eventually get plugged into those noise demonstrations and get out there and do similar things.
What kind of response do you get from the guards and the police when you go to these institutions and start setting off fireworks and making noise? And I understand sometimes there's like some spray paint, stuff like that. What kind of interactions do you find happen at these noise demos?
Yeah, it seems like depending on where you are, the more rural you get, and the rural and smaller facilities are usually like you might never see the police, and you might never see any staff person or correctional officer inside of the facility even come out. They just kind of ignore it. At Barton Street, we've been doing it for so long that pretty much police just come to make sure that traffic isn't obstructed and let people do everything that they're doing. There has been years where things have escalated thanks to like an overzealous correctional officer who just feels like they have total control over the situation and does some really stupid thing, like run into a crowd of people and starts pushing people around, and things get out of control then. But for the most part, we actually get to control how things escalate and keep things actually pretty relaxed and calm and simple, where we get to arrive when we want to, leave when we want to, and more often than not, never even see police or correctional officers. And when we do, they just make sure that we're not trying to do some sort of a jailbreak or some elaborate thing. But I think they're generally happy to just let us do our thing and leave, because anything else seems to just escalate situations. But it's a pretty relaxed environment, and people get to choose how they engage with it. So I know a lot of people have felt hesitant about going out to them, or, you know, might feel anxious just about the noise from, like, fireworks and stuff like that. But after they come out and see it and see that they can kind of, like, keep their distance or, like, engage however they please, or kind of, like, you know, it's a choose-your-own-adventure. Generally, people get really excited about them and come back year after year once they see that the response inside the prisons is very enthusiastic, and people really seem to appreciate having people come out on that day to show a bit of, like, love and solidarity.
That was the song London Dungeon by The Misfits. You're listening to the Prison Radio Show on CKUT 90.3 FM. It is 11:20 in the morning. Before that, you heard an interview with Kingston's Prison Radio Show with someone who organized the New Year's Eve noise demonstration in Hamilton, Ontario this year. Next, we wanted to share a news item with you. On our last show, we interviewed Daniel McGowan from the Certain Days Calendar Collective about a package restriction that New York State Department of Corrections was pilot introducing to certain prisons in New York State. We wanted to let you all know that the day after we aired that interview, the New York State Corrections Department suspended the program and said that they're going to go back to the drawing board and try and figure out a different program. Presumably, they will come back with something else, so potentially you will hear more news about this in the future, but we wanted to share the news that that program was canceled. Next, we wanted to share an update from Operation Push in Florida, which is a work strike that's currently underway in Florida prisons. According to the Incarcerated Workers Organizing Committee, which is a part of the IWW, quote, there has been active participation or repression of some sort in the following prisons: Santa Rosa, Jackson, Gulf, Hamilton, Avon Park, Franklin, Holmes, Everglades, Reception and Medical Center at Lake Butler, Liberty, Lowell, Columbia, Florida State Prison, Suwanee, Calhoun, and Martin, and the list is growing every day. IWOC also noted that key contacts inside have reported being threatened by the administration with harsher retaliation if correspondence with advocacy groups such as Fight Toxic Prisons and the Incarcerated Workers Organizing Committee continues. According to prisoners' reports, some facilities have shut off state phone service as of Tuesday, January 16th. The strike began on Monday, January 15th. A security threat group investigator employed at a prison in the Panhandle confirmed that multiple prisons across the state were placed on lockdown in preparation for the strike. Shakedowns have occurred where independent means of communication were confiscated and their alleged owners or users were thrown in solitary confinement. IWOC contextualized news of this work strike by noting that the movement on the inside of Florida's prison system has become known for its moments of upheaval and crackdown, such as the unexpected uprising at Holmes on September 7, 2017, 2 days prior to the national wave of prisoner-led actions commemorating the Attica anniversary, followed by uprisings at 10 other facilities which had little to no previous connection to outside support. For those who haven't heard about Operation Push, it started on January 15th, 2018. Prisoners in the state of Florida are ceasing work and demanding the following things. Number one, payment for work, rather than the current slave arrangement. Two, an end to outrageous canteen prices. And three, the reintroduction of parole incentives for lifers. The strikers are also expressing support for the following goals, quote, stop the overcrowding and acts of brutality committed by officers throughout FDOC, which have resulted in the highest death rates in history, expose the environmental conditions faced by prisoners in the Florida system, including extreme temperatures, mold, and contaminated water, honor the moratorium on state executions, and restore voting rights as a basic human right to all, not a privilege regardless of criminal convictions. To support those on strike on the inside, Operation Push solidarity protests across Florida have included demonstrations at the Gainesville Work Camp Prison, a Miami parole office, and the Lake Butler Reception/Medical Center Prison, where hundreds of participants were seen and heard directly by thousands of prisoners and DOC employees at this facility. If you want to find out more about the strike and ways to support the prisoners in the Florida system, you can visit the website incarceratedworkers.org, and we will continue to share updates about the strike here on the Prison Radio Show.
It is 11:23, and you are indeed listening to the Prison Radio Show here on SKUT 90.3 FM. Next on the show, we are going to hear an interview with the Final Straw Radio with Walida Imarisha, who is an author. And so we thought that before the interview, we would share with you a couple of her spoken word poems. The first we're going to hear is Graffiti Poem. And after that, we're going to hear Sky's The Limit. The program is in black and fading to
you now. You gotta tag trains, he said, twirling a spray paint can like a six shooter. Walls are nice and all, but how are people as far as St. Louis and Cali gonna see your name? Now that's immortality. Train tracks crisscross this country like the River Lythe, where truth is what is remembered, embedded into the soil and into our history, into our memories, as mighty engines rumble over uneasingly sleeping ground. Outlaws used to rob trains, conquering the expanding force of civilization that had carried them to the West, like unwanted children vomited them onto unfamiliar ground, only to have them return in a prodigal blaze of bullets and perform manifest destiny on the cargo that slept in its belly, where they had refused to sleep. One graph artist said, I can't afford no billboards, this is my billboard. One slave said, here is your freedom, holding aloft a gun. Others preferred to make their voices heard through the soles of their feet rather than the barrels of rifles. Their feet, which metamorphosized into wheels as they rumbled through the Underground Railroad, liberating property, not as outlaws, but as contraband. They stole themselves in plantation holdups. And wasn't John Henry trying to hold up progress when he challenged that train to a duel? Yeah, they had to use that steam-powered, powerful engine to push his dead body off of the tracks he laid with his two slave hands. They dumped his body at the side of the road, imported Asian labor to drive rails through his still warm shell, the blood from his burst heart mixing with the screams of stolen land, stolen red land, while Chinese exclusion laws were forced to build the Industrial Revolution on John Henry's back. They rode trains over that brother until he disappeared, became a breathing part of the earth. Rails expanding like lungs, breathing out locomotive trains, which during the Depression transported hobos from one end of this country to the other in a period where times were hard for everyone and a whole lot harder for some. Ask the Scottsboro boys, or at least the one remaining, because when these young men tried to ride the rails to escape crushing southern poverty and sharecropping destinies, they found themselves at the end of a courtroom noose. Freedom of movement comes with a price for those who are still contraband. Just as spray paint cans are contraband in a place with no free walls, only blank walls, only prison walls. So static and lifeless, you long to see paint and words and pictures fly by in a blur. You long to see yourself fly by in a blur, embedded into boxcars coloring the countryside at every stop, dripping pieces of fear and sweat and pride onto the blood-soaked stolen land where once outlaws dared to defy the unquestioned faceless authority of the train tracks, which still cut this country like a surgeon's blade. Just as nightly train yards are defiled by voices screaming to be heard from tags rumbling across the country, etched into the side of manifest destiny. Now that's immortality. The end. Finished revolution, born of the streets, blood pours down the concrete in turn, birthing tracks in a studio laid down on wax, manifesting telltale stories, duplicating and recreating the entire color spectrum. Visions of the brown berets, haunted by the CIA, undulating, vibrating, penetrating the beats, masturbating to itself and in turn inseminating segments of the population with the Viet Cong fighting style. Staggering through a minefield, caught unawares, kamikaze situations. Night falls, belly crawls through the tall grass. Looped it with an SP-1200 like the Ho Chi Minh Trail, clearing out the stale, empty posturings of this almost lost, or perhaps a lost and found generation. Turn the station and find static. The televisions, me back at myself in stereo surround sound, surrounded, fast closing in, hit the dirt or assume the position. Makes no difference. Do not attempt to control us. We are in control of the control. Ciphering with the speed of a raised fist like this was the 68 Olympics. And we're bombing cities and bombing buildings with spray paint A-bombs twist off the top. You never stop to read the handwriting on the wall. Well, with blood in my eye, George Jackson resurrected and to be corrected by the Department of Corrections is akin to being overruled by empty objections. Cause for pause, being Mumia Abu-Jamal, still sitting in a cell. Who volunteers for a trip to the jungles of Chiapas? The print of the Zapatistas mark me and with Sully on my forehead. I can't hope to stop this. Increase the insurrection. Attica, Attica. Turntable spin with the prestige of a Mac 10 more or less deadly. And we become the repository for chains left unbroken. The beat drops. And the mic slinks through the streets, twisting around this nation's larynx, sanity cracks, strange fruit hanging from Detroit lampposts, hypercross like stars in a load too heavy to be laid down, drowns out the silent screams of burning Buddhist monks, revolutionaries shot dead while they slept, children who've never wept. And thanks to modern technology, they are mass marketed, circumcised, and commodified for a larger audience. And bebop is lost, and crap rap is king, and fools talk about shh, ayo. I rock the mic like Malik al-Shabazz, dropping bombs like this was Vietnam. Do you really? You might rock the mic like Fidel Castro, but if you're a counter-revolutionary, then COINTELPRO Incendiary's got Castro rolling over in his soon-to-be grave. Forget the dat machine. Che Guevara stalking through the hills, but without making moves, movement is lost, as are you. Culture vultures are perched on warheads, waiting to drop something on your head. And while you talk about how this mic here is sacred, you desecrate and defecate on the holy shrines of our ancestors, talking about, I don't know, straight from the hip or the shoulder. But when Huey Newton slipped, who caught him? Uncle Sam, with arms wide open, burying down into the belly of the beast, underground, ripping from the inside out until I can finally breathe, finally understanding the powers that be are terrified because we be the power. And if I play this track backwards, voices scream for more than apple pie or a cabin in the sky, but I decide to just let it drop. But the record is not over yet. The revolution is not over yet.
That was Sky's the Limit, performed by Walida Imarisha. And before that, we heard Graffiti Poem here on CQT 90.3 FM, the Prison Radio Show. Next, we are going to hear an interview that The Final Straw conducted with Walida Imarisha. She is an author of the book Angels with Dirty Faces. And in this interview, Walida talks about her book, which deals with the justice system in the United States, transformative justice and prison abolition through creative nonfiction essays.
So we are here with Walida Imarisha, author of Angels with Dirty Faces and co-editor of Octavia's Brood. Thank you so much for coming onto the show. Would you introduce yourself a little bit more and talk a little bit about what you do?
Sure. Thanks for having me. My name's Walida Imarisha, and I'm an educator and a writer, and I work in a number of different areas, but I see my work all tying together as trying to claim our right to the future and trying to be able to move folks towards imagining and then creating better and more just futures.
So you've done a lot of like lectures, and you said you're an educator and a writer, and you wrote this book, Angels with Dirty Faces, a couple of years ago. Would you describe this book for anyone who hasn't read it yet?
Sure. It's Angels with Dirty Faces, Three Stories of Crime, Prison, and Redemption. It's a creative nonfiction book that looks at the criminal legal system, at prisons, and at the idea of harm and accountability through the narrative and the stories of three people. And my goal in putting the book out was to create spaces where we can have conversations about the idea of what happens when harm is done. So when there's been harm done in communities, when folks have hurt each other, then what happens? And the book doesn't answer that question, but what I realized in doing my work as a prison abolitionist is that we needed to humanize those folks who are incarcerated and also folks who have done harm, and they actually aren't necessarily the same people, because those folks have been dehumanized and we can't begin to have conversations about how to heal communities when we're imagining folks in the communities not as human beings who have made, in some cases, incredibly atrocious mistakes, but as monsters.
Yeah, that resonates a lot with me. And one of the questions that we were really interested about was this kind of disposability mindset that the world at large seems to have for so many people, and that's certainly conditioned on forces of classism and racism and anti-blackness, particularly.
Absolutely. Yeah, I think that when you live in a capitalist society, everything becomes a commodity, including human beings. And I think that, you know, it's very clear that, you know, when I think there's been a lot of amazing scholarship and work done about this, the connections between systems of racial oppression like slavery and the prison system, and recognizing that the prison system is not about safety. It's not about reducing crime. It's about exploitation and control of potentially rebellious communities. And, you know, folks like Angela Davis, Ruthie Gilmore, Michelle Alexander have moved these conversations in the public. And so I think it's important to have a historical and larger framework around it so that we can see it's not just that people are being thrown away, it's that certain folks especially are being thrown away because they were never wanted in the first place.
What do you feel that when we talk about the end of prison, what would need to be true of our society in order for us to stop throwing people away?
I think it's, you know, it's important to talk about what abolition is. And I think that, you know, Angela Davis has a great short book that she wrote called Abolition Democracy that's based on the ideas of W.E.B. Du Bois. And him talking about the fact that, you know, because calling ourselves prison abolitionists is specifically and directly linking back to abolitionists who are fighting against slavery. And Du Bois was writing about slavery and said that, you know, abolition is not just the end of slavery. It is the presence of justice for those who were enslaved. It is the ability to participate fully in society. So it's not just a tearing down. It's actually a replacement and a building up of those folks who had for so long been, you know, exploited and brutalized and terrorized. And I think that that's a very important and useful framing when we're talking about prison abolition, because I think when we talk about prison abolition, often folks think only of tearing down the walls. They think of an absence. And the question becomes, well, then, you know, if you want to tear down the prisons, then what? And I think that for many prison abolitionists, we believe that abolition as a mindset is about ending this carceral mentality, this idea that of punishment and retribution that prisons are founded on. But it's also about creating systems that actually focus on keeping communities whole and safe, and when harm is done, to healing those communities. And so I think it's important to recognize that abolition is not just about destruction. It's also about creation. And Alexis Pauline Gums, who is an amazing Black feminist visionary thinker, wrote, "What if abolition is a growing thing?" And I think that that idea of abolition as growing, as a garden, as a plant, rather than just as a wrecking ball, is a really powerful one.
Just to get back to the book, I was really taken with the style that the book was written in, the narrative or creative nonfiction. And I'm really interested about the evolution of this book. Would you talk a little bit about how it changed stylistically throughout the writing process?
Sure. So Angels with Dirty Faces focuses on three people's stories. Myself, my adopted brother, Keiko Mia, who is currently incarcerated in California, and James McElroy, also known as Jimmy Mac, who was a member of the Westies, which was the Irish mob that ran Hell's Kitchen in New York from the 1960s to the 1980s, and also served as hitmen for the Gambino family, for John Gotti, for the Teflon Don. And the book actually began because Jimmy Mac and my brother were incarcerated in the same place and got to know each other. And Jimmy Mac had never done an interview with any journalist, but because of my brother, he agreed to do an interview with me. And through doing that process, he, you know, was like, "Do you want to write my biography?" And I was like, "Yes, this would be fascinating." But as I began to write the biography, I realized that it was something that was growing. I have been doing work around prisons and justice within prisons for, you know, 20 years more than. And I couldn't help but want to bring that into talking about Jimmy Mac, to give it a framework and to be able to give a full picture of these ideas of crime, of violence, of prisons, of justice that are so, you know, racialized, that are so much about class and gender and sexual identity, and are so much used as a method of social control. And so the book just grew from there to include my brother, to include myself, and then to include the work that I've done, which has been a lot around Black liberation, political prisoners. And so I really began to realize that I think the best way to change folks' minds is through stories. And I think that what really causes a deep shift within a person is being able to emotionally connect with someone else's experiences. And I think that is part of the reason that this system works so hard to dehumanize those who it is scared of. Because if we are not people, if we are things, then there's less of a possibility of other folks in society empathizing, connecting, and then seeing the ways that the system functions. And so I felt like sharing that, those stories, would be an important way to create a shift. So the creative nonfiction genre is, it's just kind of like a giant snatch bag with a lot of things in it. But, you know, my book definitely, it includes statistics, it includes history, it includes analysis, it also includes personal narrative. I'm a poet, so some of the writing incorporates the aesthetic of poetics. So it definitely is a hybrid creature, but I think that that's actually how we live our lives, is seeing everything connected rather than in these neat boxes.
Yes, and that is one of the most remarkable aspects of the book. I can only imagine that this is something that people comment on to you frequently about it. The way that you just charted that evolution of, you know, kind of talking about Jimmy Mack and then realizing that more stories need to be included sounds very natural and organic. And yet the stories that you chose to include about yourself and your brother were highly personal. And I was wondering, you know, because I suppose you could have chosen to talk about some other folks who were incarcerated who you had learned about or corresponded with, but you chose to speak about yourself and your relationship with your brother and your family. I wonder if you could like reflect a little bit on the choice to not just to widen the scope of the book from one story to multiple stories, but specifically to those stories.
Sure. Well, as I was, you know, working on what I thought would be the biography for Jimmy Mack, I came to feel that, you know, I was really connected with Jimmy and with this process. I mean, the reason that Jimmy spoke to me was my brother. And, you know, we got to a place where, you know, Jimmy was calling me his niece and said I was an honorary Westie, which I was like, I don't know that I want to do that, but thank you. and, you know, I felt like I was very much a part of the story. And I think that any idea of objectivity is a fallacy in human beings. I don't think you can be objective. And I think that folks who say they're being objective in their writing, in their creation, in their education, teaching, they are either lying to you or to themselves. I think that the most principled thing is to be clear about your subjectivity and to be clear about how your subjectivity affects the information you're presenting, and then allow the reader to engage with it on that level. And so that's what I began doing. And as I was doing that, I was realizing that these conversations around harm, around crime, around violence were things that I was also grappling with personally. And so, you know, my brother was arrested and tried at the age of 16, tried as an adult and has served almost 30 years in prison at this point. And then, you know, I had actually gone through a failed accountability process, a community accountability process with my partner at the time who had sexually assaulted me. And really recognizing that these stories are not stories that are easy to discuss. These are not stories that there is a neat, simple ending that can be created. But these complicated, messy, difficult, painful stories are the ones we have to talk about, because if we don't talk about them, then any conception of justice that we're creating will eventually derail when we get to places like that. And so I think that, you know, for me, we have to go into those places that make us uncomfortable, that make us scared, that are painful, to be able to sit with the complexities and contradictions of of humanity. And I think that's the only way that we can build new systems of justice, new processes to address harm, new ways to keep communities safe that will actually both be effective and will embody the values and principles that we have and that we want for this new world.
Yeah. And I wanted to say that one of the things that really challenged me in the book, when you talk about sitting with that complexity, was you talk about how Kekemia really resisted becoming an informant and like really didn't want to play that role, but eventually did. And that was like really painful for him. It was difficult for you. And like, it really made me sit with the complexity of that, because I think in the circles that I run in, you know, there is this kind of like anti-snitch kind of thing. And it's like this very knee-jerk, very all or nothing kind of approach that can just be so harsh toward people who do that. And on the one hand, like, yes, it's a decision that we can condemn. But on the other hand, it's also you capture the horrible choice of that like so well in the book. And so I just wanted to like say that just for me, that was a moment where the story really forced me to sit with that complexity. So thank you.
Yeah, thanks. And I think that I just want to be, I mean, Kekemia is anti-snitch and, you know, hates himself for debriefing, and also probably wouldn't be alive if he hadn't debriefed. And both of those things that are in seeming contradiction with each other are absolutely true. And I think that it is important to take into account context. I think that one of the many things that is so flawed with the criminal legal system is the idea that people fit neatly into categories and human interactions fit neatly into categories. And so we can predict what needs to happen when a situation occurs. And I think one of the things that's really powerful about the idea of transformative justice, which is, you know, part of, you know, prison abolition is part of that, is the idea of saying, you know, as we're living the values we have for this new world, how are we respecting that every human interaction is different, is unique, and how are we responding to that and creating situations that address that moment? And I think that's one of the things that is so both challenging and powerful about transformative justice, is that it accepts that each situation is unique.
I'm wondering about what the reception of the book has been, like either critically or, you know, if you've done book events, like what has the, how have people received the book?
The reception has been really good for the book. I think I definitely was very nervous about putting out the book for many reasons. Because the book is so deeply personal for myself and for Kekemia and for Jimmy Mack, as well as other folks whose stories are partially told in the book, I wanted it to be as honest as possible. And I tried to be honest and accountable to those folks. Jimmy and Kekemia read different versions of the book. They got to see the book and give feedback on it. And I felt that was very important, especially writing about folks who are incarcerated, where so much has been taken from them. I did not want to take their stories and their experiences from them as well and use it to my own ends. So even though I worked to try and make the book as honest and as real as possible, that also meant that all of us are kind of laid open for the world, which was, you know, very scary idea, I think. And the response to the book has been really incredible and powerful. It's, I think, what has honored me the most is when folks whose families members are incarcerated, people who have been incarcerated, and folks who are survivors of sexual assault all say that they felt like they saw themselves and their experiences reflected accurately in the book, and that the complexities of that, which they live with every day, was something that was, you know, in the book. And that to me was the highest honor that I could receive in relationship to the book. But the response has been powerful from all sectors, and I won the Creative Nonfiction Award for the Oregon Book Awards in 2017, and that has kind of given a new round of interest in the book. So it's been really powerful to use the book as a way to have conversations in communities, and as a way for communities to begin having that dialogue of saying, well, then what do we do? And what can we create now that can be ready when harm happens in our community? Given positive feedback to him about it.
That's awesome. You touched on accountability processes several times, and they are kind of the thorn, you know, kind of a thorn in the side of the far left in a way, and they probably don't work as well as we like to believe that they work. I was wondering if you could reflect on accountability processes a little bit and kind of talk a little bit about, can we boil down the failure of these processes to individual flaws, or is there some sort of structural component that structural aspect to their consistently, you know, lukewarm results?
I think one of the biggest things, and I talk about this in Angels, I think a lot of the problem is what we consider to be failure and success, and how we are judging community accountability processes, especially when it has been serious harm that's been done around, especially around intimate violence and sexual violence. And I think that we have the idea that is very much, you know, a product of this, you know, capitalist society, that we can find a quick fix for these things, and that we can create something that at the end of the day, everyone will feel healed and will feel whole and will move on from. And I think that those are fairly unrealistic expectations. I think that there is no quick fix to healing, and there is no quick fix in the process of transformation. And so, you know, for me, what I've really come to think about is, are the individuals and is the community at the quote unquote end of the accountability process healed enough that they are able to continue their healing and growth and accountabilities in a less formal structure afterwards? And I think that if that was one of the criteria, we may see accountability processes very different. But I think that, you know, we have to begin shifting the ways we talk about harm that is done, the ways we talk about who is doing this harm, because I think that, you know, and I think things like the Me Too campaign and this response to individual men who have committed sexual assault and sexual harassment is, you know, we have to see that it is pervasive, that it is something that happens. We often talk about how many, you know, women and gender nonconforming folks have experienced sexual assault, but we don't talk about how many folks are assaulting, right? And I think that we have to talk about that, because that is where it is most awful and uncomfortable to think about people in our lives, people we care about, people we respect, who are committing this harm. And yet that is the case. And if we don't talk about that, we can't begin to actually transform our communities. And then we just rely on these individual instances and our response to them, which will continually feel inadequate unless we begin to really shift how we're thinking about it and have these larger conversations about the culture and the pervasiveness of intimate violence and sexual violence.
I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about beyond just like your brother and who you write about, your experience with supporting incarcerated people and like maybe just kind of your best practices around that.
Yeah. I mean, I don't know that I have a checklist, but I think for me, I have been incredibly lucky and honored to learn and be mentored by many different folks who have been and are incarcerated, and to, you know, to work in solidarity and as compañeros with those folks. And I would not be the person I am as a human, as someone involved in change, or as an artist without the mentorship and guidance and leadership of folks who are incarcerated. And so for me, I think it's important to see folks who are incarcerated, who you are engaging with, you know, as A, part of the community, because they absolutely are, and B, as, you know, folks you are working with rather than helping or working for. And I think that a lot of folks who get involved come in and are, you know, are often, you know, white folks. They come in with a savior mentality, and folks who are incarcerated and more broadly people of color do not need saviors. They need allies, because some of the most courageous, innovative, incredible organizing work is happening in prisons behind these walls in some of the worst conditions possible. And we on the outside have so much to learn, and we need that wisdom. We need that leadership. We need that ingenuity and creativity and bravery. And so I think it's important to come from that perspective rather than coming from the perspective of, I'm doing this to help this person, rather coming from the perspective of saying, I'm doing this because we are both in a shared struggle, and this person has a lot to share with me about that. And I want to be in communion and in conversation with this person to be able to make our communities and our world better.
That was an interview with Walida Imarisha, conducted by folks from The Final Straw. This version was edited for our show, so if you would like to listen to the entire interview, you can visit thefinalstrawradio.noblogs.org. You can check out past episodes of The Prison Radio Show at prisonradioshow.wordpress.com. You can also follow us on Twitter at Prison Radio Show. The Prison Radio Show airs twice a month here on SQT. We're on the air on the second Thursday of the month at 5 p.m. and the fourth Friday at 11 a.m. So this means that our next show will air on Thursday, February 8th at 5 p.m. If you have any questions on anything that you've heard on today's show, from the New Year's Eve noise demo report back, to Operation Push, to the interview with Walida Imarisha, or if you wish to be involved with the Prison Radio Show, you can contact us. We have an email address. It's prison@skiut.ca. Formerly incarcerated people are especially encouraged to participate. People can also leave a message on our listener comment line. It's 514-448-4041, extension 2547. If you are in prison, we encourage you to participate in the show in any way possible. You can write to us at The Prison Radio Show, or simply write PRS on the envelope, care of CKUT, 3647 University Street, Montreal, Quebec, H3A2B3. Thanks so much for tuning in. Stay tuned for Butcher T's Noontime Cuts. That's coming up next.